Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Well, as you may know, Diane fell and cracked her pelvis last week. Good news today, she's doing well and will leave the hospital tomorrow to recuperate at home. She sends thanks for all your good wishes. The U.S. military says an American service member died in a bomb blast in Afghanistan this morning. That makes August the deadliest month of the 8-year war for U.S. forces. In Iran, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad on Friday called for the leaders of the opposition to be prosecuted over post-election turmoil. And Japanese voters go to the polls for an election expected to remove the party, which has ruled almost continuously since 1955. Joining me in the studio for the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup, Barbara Slavin of the Washington Times. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show, Barbara.
Thank you.
And David Ignatius of the Washington Post. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Susan.
And joining us for the first time, Janine Zakaria of Bloomberg News. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show, Janine.
Hi.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850. Or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, August is now the deadliest month in Afghanistan for U.S. troops, David, and we see growing concern, I think, in the American public about this war.
Poll numbers show support among the American public for the war, certainly for any expansion of U.S. military forces there going down. It's clear that the Obama administration is going to have a tough set of decisions this fall. General Petraeus would love to defer decision about future troop levels until next year when it's easier to see the effects of the additional 21,000 troops that have been added. I don't think that's going to be possible. And you can already see the outlines of the debate. The military, led by our general there, General McChrystal, the new commander, is arguing that with more resources, we can really rock the Taliban in this post-election period and begin next year to consolidate security, make deals with local Taliban commanders as part of the idea. But I think there's a fear, especially after the election and the uncertainty surrounding the result, that the political fragmentation in Afghanistan, that's part of the problem, the corruption that's said to surround the regime of President Karzai, is going to be a continuing problem going forward. So already within the administration, there are strong voices, I'm told, led by Vice President Joe Biden, saying, we really shouldn't deepen our bets in Afghanistan. It's time to look very, very critically at this. I think Biden would like to see us begin to pull the number of troops down, not increase them.
Well, of course, President Obama, as a candidate, talked about Afghanistan as the right war, the war we had to win. Barbara, what would be the consequences for the administration kind of shifting position and trying to reduce the U.S. presence there?
Be very, very tricky. But as David pointed out, we're really in a tough situation. You know, they just had their presidential elections last week, and there are numerous allegations of fraud. At the Washington Times, we had the head of the International Federation for Election Systems. This is IFES. It helps election commissions around the world organize elections, and the head of that said basically that they were very disappointed, that don't expect a successful outcome from these elections because of the allegations of ballot box stuffing, particularly in southern Afghanistan, where the Taliban has free reign. A lot of the polling places could not operate properly.
Fraud, accusations of fraud coming from both sides. What do you make of the fraud allegations, Janine? How corrupted does the election seem to be?
Well, I don't think anybody has a really true handle on the depth of it, but there's certainly everyone seems to agree, as Barbara pointed out, that there has been ballot stuffing and fraud and things of that nature, as the U.S. envoy raised in a meeting with President Karzai on August 21st in Kabul, where they got into a sort of tense screaming match. Of course, Ambassador Holbrooke is known for his tough words and tough tactics, but the U.S. is in a bit of a pickle because they want to support whoever the winner is. They want to be able to work with Karzai. But as the New York Times deftly pointed out this week, also his vice presidential running mate, one of many people corrupted by drug trafficking, how are they going to deal with him? Will they sanction him? So a lot at stake for the U.S. here.
Well, Janine, there were reports in the British press that Ambassador Holbrooke actually stormed out of this meeting. that he had. Wouldn't that reflect a lot of disquiet on the part of Americans with someone who's been an ally?
There's no doubt that the U.S. satisfaction with Karzai has been growing even before Ambassador Holbrooke took the post. I spoke to a U.S. official last night who disputed that he actually stormed out. But anybody who knows Richard Holbrooke knows that he's not exactly quiet and soft, or, you know, and fuzzy. So I wouldn't be surprised if things did get tense, given how significant the stakes are for the U.S.
So for the United States, David, is it does the United States better serve its interest if Karzai wins or if he loses?
Well, Holbrooke and all senior U.S. officials have been studiously noncommittal on that point, I think fearing that they'd influence the outcome one way or the other, probably in the opposite way they intended. To me, one of the most worrying aspects of the current post-election situation is that with essentially every candidate, all five candidates in the race, making claims of ballot stuffing and fraud, we are facing a period of weeks and I suspect months before the outcome is really clarified. And this reminds me of what happened in Iraq at the time that the U.S. was trying to get traction in 2005, 2006. These long delays in forming governments, uncertainty as to who was running what ministry, lack of accountability. In other words, all of the essential governance issues that experts say are at the heart of the problem in Afghanistan, I think we're going to get it worse simply because of this long post-election period of charges and countercharges. I know the White House is worrying about this. As of the last time I talked to people this week, they didn't know what to do about it.
Barbara?
Yeah, no, I would concur. Their fraud allegations can be, I believe, received until September 17th. There are supposed to be some preliminary results announced then. If neither of the major candidates gets over 50% of the vote, they have to have a runoff, which wouldn't happen until October. There was a big problem with election security on August the 20th. So how are they going to provide security for a runoff? The turnout was very low. How are they going to get more turnout after this prolonged period? So the problem is that these elections have to look credible to the Afghan people, and that looks increasingly unlikely.
Elections Sunday in Japan, and Janine, a lot of predictions. We're going to see what in the United States we would call a change election. What do we expect to see happen there?
Well, the Democratic Party of Japan, a newly formed party just 11 years ago, is looking like it's going to win more than 300 seats. Up from the 112 it now currently holds in the lower house of parliament there. And so certainly a big shift that the U.S., of course, is going to be watching closely, I'd say, on a couple of fronts. One of the things that the DPJ has campaigned on is sort of a reevaluation of the way the U.S. and Japan interact. They want to be on more equal footing. You're going to see a lot of talk about the looking at, for example, the status of forces agreement between the U.S. and Japan, possible questioning of U.S. refueling in Japan, the operations of U.S. forces there, and also, of course, the Japanese economy, definitely something the Obama administration is going to be watching very closely. Their jobless rate hit a record 5.7% just this week, and so there's a lot of uncertainty in Japan economically. One of the things that's fueling the DPJ towards victory.
But the Liberal Democratic Party there has been in power for so long, David. What went wrong with this ruling
party?
Well,
you could argue that they finally are dying of exhaustion, total stagnation. The Japanese Liberal Democratic Party, people always know this is the ultimate oxymoron, it's neither liberal nor democratic, has been such a fixture of Japanese life. Japan has been a kind of one-party state, and all the key decisions in that political system have been made within the party in often very corrupt deals that it's said have been part of the stagnation of Japanese life in general. 20 years ago, I read a book that really stayed with me by a man named Carol van Wolfren, who was a Dutch analyst who lived many years in Japan, called The Enigma of Japanese Power. And he made the point that with the LDP system, Japan really didn't have a political system that could make choices and announce policies. Maybe, finally, this Sunday, that will break. And the hold of this party, I want to say the stranglehold, will be broken.
Well, there's another aspect which one has to pay attention to, and that's the Japanese bureaucracy. And a number of commentators are saying, yes, the prime minister may change. You know, we may get a 62-year-old Stanford-educated engineer, but the bureaucracy will not change. And this is really what runs Japan, has always run Japan, ran Japan when there was an emperor, ran Japan during World War II, and for all these years that the LDP has been in power. So will the bureaucrats release their death grip off Japanese policy. This new party, the Democratic Party, is promising a lot of things on the domestic front. They're promising to pay subsidies of over $200 a month per child to Japanese who have kids, in part to get people to have children because Japan is in demographic decline, among other things. So we will have to see, does Japan have the money for these kinds of social programs, and will the bureaucracy let them happen?
Japan has the world's lowest percentage of children and highest percentage of elderly, which is part of a big economic problem. You can imagine that. But Janine, is there concern among American policymakers about what this new government might want to do? You mentioned before that they want to re-examine some of the longstanding relationships between our two countries.
I think at the moment the Obama administration is taking a wait-and-see approach, but definitely that's on their radar. I mean, Barbara knows from traveling with the Secretary of State as well, you always refuel in Japan on the way there. It's that the U.S. security arrangement with Japan has been entrenched for decades. So if they actually try to move on that, that's certainly going to cause some significant concern. And definitely, as Barbara was pointing out, these subsidies that they're planning, something that everybody's going to be watching to see if that actually takes place, how this is going to affect the economy in general there.
All right, David.
There are just two final points I'd make. The key thing when we think about the global economy is whether Japan will be strong enough, dynamic enough to reflate and to be a real engine pulling in imports from the rest of the world, maybe even U.S. products being sold to Japan. The second thing is the Bush administration and the Obama administration has followed in this, succeeded in something really delicate, which was to improve relations with both Japan and China. And if they can continue that, that will be a neat trick.
We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll go to the phones. We're going to take some of your calls. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. And we'll talk about the situation in Iraq and an unexpected bombing in Saudi Arabia. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio for the second hour of our news roundup, Barbara Slavin. She's Assistant Managing Editor for World and National Security at the Washington Times. And David Ignatius. He's a columnist with the Washington Post and co-moderator of Post Global on WashingtonPost.com. And Janine Zakaria. She is a diplomatic correspondent with Bloomberg News. Lots of developments in Iraq this week, including the death of a Shiite leader. Tell us what's happening there, Barbara.
Yeah, Abdulaziz al-Hakim headed something which used to be called the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, SCIRI. It changed its name to the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, taking out revolution. But it's a very important organization. It was essentially created in Iran by Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps in the 1980s, after the beginning of the Iran-Iraq War. The Hakims returned to Iraq after the U.S. overthrew Saddam. And Abdulaziz Hakim has had lung cancer for some time, and so this is not unexpected. But it still happens at a very delicate phase where we are anticipating elections in Iraq next year, and there is a reorganization going on among the Shiite parties. His party, others affiliated with Muqtada Sadr, a militant leader with Ahmed Chalabi, who we'll talk about in a little bit, have formed an alliance that excludes the prime minister, who is a Shiite, Nouri al-Maliki. And they are all maneuvering to see who will take power as the U.S. withdraws from Iraq.
How important is this situation, David, and how perilous for U.S. interests?
Well, as the U.S. now withdraws its forces in earnest from Iraq, we pulled back from the cities and are really not a factor in day-to-day security, we are seeing an increase in violence and in political chaos in the country. The death of Abdulaziz Hakim, a figurehead for the Shiite religious parties, is an example of this. But in every direction that I look at Iraq, I see similar uncertainty. Maliki is increasingly cocky about his own role as prime minister, and I think has decided that he thinks he can go it alone, separating himself from the other Shiite parties. He's got his own complicated dealings with Iran. You've got the Kurds who are pushing for their own interests ever more stridently. I think the question that we need to think about is, going forward in Iraq, is this project of a new Iraqi state that was created in 2003 after the United States invasion, do Iraqis think it's going to continue, and are they going to buy into it, and are they going to make the deals that would be part of having some kind of viable country and democracy? And right now, it's really tough to be confident about that.
Janine?
Yeah, just to follow up on what David was saying, I think the August 19th coordinated attacks where nearly 100 people were killed and 600 were wounded, and U.S. forces who had pulled back on June 30th were sitting on the outskirts and couldn't get in there because the Iraqis had not invited them. I think this is something the U.S. is going to be looking closely at going forward, and we have to see how that's going to affect Obama's promises of doing a complete U.S. pullout by the end of 2011. And just quickly on al-Hakim, some people have said that he's been, because of his illness, as Barbara said, he hasn't been as important day-to-day in Shiite politics right now. And one U.S. diplomat I spoke to said they're hoping actually this will clear the way for fresh Shia leadership within that party who can challenge Muqtada al-Sadr, who's the more radical concern for them.
David.
I met Abdulaziz Hakim's son, Ammar, who's the new leader of this party. We had a long and very interesting breakfast conversation. And he's the sort of young man who, you know, when you meet him and talk to him, you think, gee, maybe things are really going to work out in this country. He is surrounded by some of the toughest, meanest politicians. And I think of this nice young man, this cleric from Najaf, getting eaten alive by the wolves of Baghdad.
You mentioned Barbara Chalabi, a familiar name to Americans from the very beginning of the Iraq War. What happened this week to an aide of his?
Yeah, well, the twists and turns involving Ahmed Chalabi are just incredible. This is the guy, to remind people, who led Iraqi exiles after the Gulf War, who lobbied so hard to overthrow Saddam Hussein, who presented information to the media about alleged weapons of mass destruction that didn't turn out to actually exist in Iraq once the U.S. got there. And he also, throughout this time, had maintained good relations with Iran, which makes sense if you're an Iraqi Shia, since Iran is the neighbor and the biggest Shiite country. And what we have now is more evidence that his connections with the Iranians are closer, perhaps, than we even thought. The Washington Times has a front-page story today about the arrest of a top aide to Chalabi on charges that he was a liaison to an Iraqi Shiite militant group called the League of the Righteous, which, among other things, is believed responsible for the execution-style murder of five U.S. Marines in 2007. And Chalabi, of course, denies it. The aide denies it. But senior U.S. military officials say that, indeed, Chalabi's links and the links of this aide to this group are documented, and that Chalabi has been playing both sides of the fence.
Let's go to the phones and invite some of our listeners to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. And we'll start with Lydia. She's calling us from Woodstock, Illinois. Hi, Lydia.
Oh, yes. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have to reflect on this because I read a book by Claire Sterling in the 1990s entitled Thieves' World. I believe you're familiar with her. She's an international reporter, highly regarded. Is that a person you're familiar with?
Yes, David Ignatius says he's familiar with
her. I remember Claire Sterling's reporting about radicals in Europe in particular, and reporting about who tried to kill the Pope.
Well, she actually had quite a bit in her book, Thieves' World, about organized crime networks throughout the world, and she included in that the Yakuza, out of Japan and how they are very involved in organized crime networks throughout the world, including corporate and government involvement. In fact, Prescott Bush, George H. Bush's brother, was a financial advisor, supposedly unknowingly. But the reason that I called is because I hope the Diane Reams Show can, I don't know if you have, but the involvement of Interpol was very crucial in weeding out this information. They're a international organization. I believe they have about 158 at least in their network. These are law officers and I believe attorneys. They're not political. I think they started in France.
And did you, Lydia, I'm sorry, do you have a question about this week's news?
Yes. I'd like to know if what she reported on and also what was in the PBS tape series, Lords of the Mafia, is the type of thing that we can talk about not only in Japan, but in Afghanistan, in Mexico. Mm-hmm. This is a network that is really doing all of this harm.
All right, Lydia, thanks so much for your call. Any comments from the panel? David.
Well, it has been asserted for decades that part of the stagnation of Japanese political life involved implicit deals between this ruling single party, the Liberal Democratic Party, and the Japanese underworld, the Yakuza that the caller is referring to. There have been many allegations written about that. Anything that shakes up Japanese life and society, and this Sunday election will do that, presumably would put the Yakuza, however strong they are, a little bit on the defensive.
Okay, let's go to Tacoma Park, Maryland, and talk to Andrew. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment is really about Afghanistan and the article in the New York Times of yesterday that you people touched on earlier. Hold on. Can you shut that off? Jesus.
Thank you, Andrew. Go ahead.
Yeah. All right, where was it? Oh, yeah, the article in the New York Times where it was discussing that the ex-defense minister, I guess he's still the defense minister, is running as vice president to Karzai, and that he's a major player in as a drug lord or what have you. And knowing that the Taliban is fueled with drug money, that it's the drug money that's floating the Taliban. And that, you know, way back in Bush's time, there was a deal made or a accommodation made to say, well, mm-hmm. we'll just gloss over this. That the fact that we have U.S. troops dying in Afghanistan, and in the meantime, we're supporting the enabling of the Taliban. And you know, I mean, how long can this go on? And how come such a deal is not front page?
All right, Andrew, thanks very much for your call. Barbara Slavin.
Well, the caller points out the dilemma that the U.S. is in. I mean, it's very hard to find an honest man in Afghanistan who is in a position of power. It's not just Mohammed Fahim, who's the ex-defense minister who's now running as the vice presidential candidate to Hamid Karzai. There have been allegations against a brother of Karzai. The Taliban are involved. Everybody is involved in this because this has been Afghanistan's main way of making money, unfortunately, for a number of years. The Taliban initially were opposed to the drug trade, but after 9/11, they became involved. So it just points up the dilemma the U.S. faces. What kind of government can be constructed that will be credible, that will be clean, that deserves, as the caller pointed out, the sacrifice of so many American lives?
Now, Janine, I think the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has warned Karzai about his relationship with this man.
Well, that's what the New York Times said. I wasn't able to actually shore that up yesterday, but I think what it shows is that the U.S., and I do know this from talking to Secretary Clinton, that they're going to be looking at ways of how do we deal with particular individuals that we don't like, and do we go for a more targeted sanction on them? The problem, though, as my colleagues have pointed out, though, is that it's going to be very hard to sanction the vice president of the country where you're pumping billions of dollars in. So I'm not sure they figured out how to handle it.
David, what do you think?
Well, turning Afghanistan into Minnesota or you know, with a clean, reputable political system ain't going to be easy. And there is a question of whether you're going to deal with people whose hands are dirty, who are involved in illegal activities. It is alleged that during the Bush administration, we had extensive dealings with this man, Fahim. Again, I think this is the heart of the question that the Obama administration faces. Does the country have the stomach and the will for a nation-building exercise that will seek to create good governance, end the drug trade, non-corrupt officials, you know, get guys like this defense minister out of the way, and build a new, modern country that Afghans can be proud of, that Americans will think is great? That's going to take a lot of time, money, and lives. The American people have the stomach for it. And increasingly what I hear is no.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Well, Barbara, there was a suicide attack on a senior Saudi prince last night in Saudi Arabia, the first assassination attempt against a member of the royal family there in decades. Tell us more about this story.
Yeah, this is a very serious incident. It was at a majlis being held by the son of the interior minister, Prince Mohammed. And Saudi members of the royal family typically have these gatherings where anybody is allowed to come and present a petition, raise a problem, ask for some help. And somehow a suicide bomber infiltrated this and blew himself up and did injure the prince, who is apparently recovering and is going to be okay. The Saudis have bragged that they have al-Qaeda on the run, that they have really been able to crack down on terrorism in their country. And so this is going to be a real shock and a real wake-up call to them. It's very scary that somebody, a suicide bomber, was able to get that close to a member of the royal family.
Janine, what do you think the consequences of this attack could be?
Well, as Barbara noted, it's definitely going to shake the Saudis up, although they have really launched in recent months a more aggressive campaign against members of al-Qaeda. But one thing that Saudi officials pride themselves on when you talk to them is their tight control of the society. They know where everybody is. They know who they are. They know how to find them. They know where their brother is. So this would definitely, I think, lead to a larger clampdown and some more some tighter security provisions. And I'm sure the U.S. is going to be watching it very closely as well.
David?
This young man who was targeted, Mohammed bin Nayef, U.S. officials regard as a real comer in the Saudi Interior Ministry. He's somebody who they think is very smart about security, so that's a concern. The second point to make is that there have been increasing reports over the last several months of much deeper al-Qaeda penetration of Yemen, the country that neighbors Saudi Arabia to the south. And if you believe these reports, al-Qaeda is establishing a real sanctuary in Yemen from which it can conduct operations against the Saudis, against U.S. interests in the region. So I think that that's probably going to be one of the after issues here. What's happening in Yemen? Who's going to crack down on it? What are the Saudis and the U.S. going to do about it?
Well, in fact, the Saudi Arabian crackdown on al-Qaeda has pushed perhaps these operations to Yemen and then created the turmoil there. Barbara, how seriously do you see the situation in Yemen?
Yemen is very bad. There's a kind of civil war raging in the north of the country, quite complicated. There are al-Qaeda people involved. There's a Shia sect involved there. And, of course, there have been attacks on U.S. facilities in Yemen. So, you know, it's kind of whack-a-mole. You get rid of them in one place, they pop up somewhere else. And as David pointed out, it is clearly a threat, although we do not know where this particular suicide bomber came from. We don't know for sure he was al-Qaeda, but one makes the assumption. It seems fairly easy to do in Saudi Arabia.
In Iran today, the president, Ahmadinejad, demanded prosecution of opposition leaders. We're hearing a lot of kind of conflicting messages coming out of Iran about these protests. Janine, what's happening there?
Well, it seems that you've got this sort of battle strangely going on between Ayatollah Khamenei and President Ahmadinejad, who is President Ahmadinejad is still trying to link these protesters with the West and trying to really crack down on them, put an end to it. And you had Ayatollah Khamenei yesterday coming out and saying, really, there's no evidence of the West being involved with these protesters. In other words, maybe trying to assume a position he had before the election in June of a neutral arbiter. He's a little bit wary of Ahmadinejad, a little bit wary of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, and wants to assume that power again.
You've written a book about Iran, Barbara. What do you make of the reaction inside Iran to the mass trials we've seen of officials, former officials and journalists and academics there?
Yeah. The country's political elite is split in a way that we haven't seen really since the early days of the Iranian Revolution back in 1979. And, you know, it's the supreme leader appears to be attempting now to, I mean, he's been trying all along to draw the protests to a close, to say it's over, you know, everybody should join together. But he has damaged himself completely by coming out in support of Ahmadinejad and what appear to be fraudulent results right after the elections in June. So his attempts really are not going to work. And while he's talking about reconciliation, these show trials are going on. They have taken all of the top leaders of the reformist parties and a number of academics, people who had had contacts with the West, put them on trial, made them give false confessions, and the reaction in Iran is disbelief.
We are going to take another very short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the situation in North Korea, and we'll take more of your calls, 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Frederica and Howard Stevenson, helping low-income students access education through the Summer Search Foundation at summersearch.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Be My Baby, Chapel of Love, the Do Run Run, Leader of the Pack are some of the hits of the 60s co-written by Ellie Greenwich. She died Wednesday at the age of 68. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with her. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead commemorates the centennial of Lester Young's birth. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
We've gotten an email from someone in Tokyo who writes, "The news stories that Japanese people are hoping for change and supporting the DPJ are overstated. There is no charismatic political leader like Mr. Obama in Japan. DPJ will win the election almost certainly, but our anxiety over our future will not be gone. That feeling seems to be widely shared by many people, regardless of age, gender, area where they live." I'm glad to hear we have listeners in Tokyo. David, what do you make of the comment?
Well, that's a smart, sensible comment. I think the Japanese have worried that the Japanese miracle, this engine of incredible growth and prosperity, has been winding down. And so the caller saying, yeah, we may have a new party in power, but that doesn't mean the fundamental problems that a weakened Japan will be solved. It's a fascinating comment.
We have several emails regarding Afghanistan. Tommy in Raleigh, North Carolina, who recalls anti-war protest during the Bush administration, says the Iraq war is going worse and President Obama hasn't pulled out the troops. He sent more troops to Afghanistan and it's more deadly than ever. Is President Obama going to keep his promise to bring home the troops? And another email, Scott says, hearing the discussion regarding the problems in Afghanistan, why are we there? And David from Grand Rapids, Michigan says, what are the odds of success in Afghanistan? You know, Barbara, we've been talking about Afghanistan for 8 years now mm-hmm. on the Diane Rehm Show, and this strikes me as something, you don't want to overdraw conclusions from some emails, but a slightly different tone Americans are taking than before.
Yeah, I mean, it's reflected in the poll numbers. It's been 8 years. People are getting really tired of this. And you hear people like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mike Mullen, saying, you know, as he did to us recently, that we're basically starting over because what happened, of course, after 9/11, U.S. went in, got rid of the Taliban government, and then took its eye off the ball, went to Iraq, basically ignored Afghanistan for a couple of years. And now the Taliban is stronger than ever. The drug trade is back stronger than ever. So you understand why there's a lot of frustration and fatigue. And I think the U.S. hope is simply to stabilize the place a little bit and not stay there for very much longer. You hear talk of maybe a year or so to see if this can work. And after that, I think the U.S. may begin to withdraw from Afghanistan as well.
We know that President Obama met for a private dinner about 6 weeks ago with a group of presidential historians. And reports from that indicate that several of the historians warned him that the Afghanistan war has the possibility of making the other things that he hopes to do, like health care reform, much more difficult. I know that one of the historians here compared that situation to what LBJ faced during the Vietnam War. Is that a fair comparison, do you think, David, or does that go too far?
Well, you don't have to really go beyond Afghanistan itself to understand how difficult this is. The question the administration has to ask itself is, where Britain tried to subdue a warlike Afghanistan, where the Soviet Union tried to subdue a warlike Afghanistan, and both failed at great cost, what are the reasons that we think we'll do better at that project? I've been doing a lot of reading about this history because I'm heading out there soon. And I have to be honest, I don't see yet the arguments about how this mission is going to be fundamentally different. But we've got some very smart people thinking about it. You know, the idea of just walking away, I have to say, if there's one thing we have learned, it's that the idea of just picking up and walking away and leaving a vacuum, that probably wouldn't be a good idea. That's how we got to 9/11.
Let's talk to Kevin, who's calling us from Manassas, Virginia. Kevin, do you want to discuss Iran?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for taking my call. I am originally Iranian. I'm Iranian-American. And I want to say that Mr. Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, has created a very unique opportunity for the United States government to go ahead and normalize the relationship with Iran, who has the most influence in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
Interesting point, Kevin. Of course, Janine, the United States has been debating, the administration debating exactly how to forge a new relationship with Iran.
They're not debating. They're begging. They're practically begging the Iranians to come and talk to them. And then basically the Iranians have pretty much rebuffed it. And this is all going to come to a head, I believe, next month by the time of the UN General Assembly. If there isn't something sorted out on a U.S.-Iranian dialogue about the nuclear weapons, then the U.S. is going to push for more sanctions. And this opportunity for engagement, I think, is going to diminish. Of course, the way the election was handled, the way that the aftermath, the crackdown on the protesters, the arrest certainly postponed or made it more difficult for the U.S. to engage because they didn't want to be seen as undermining the demonstrators and the freedom fighters there.
Barbara.
It made it more difficult for the Iranians to engage. I mean, we've got civil war within the Iranian political elite. You've got conservatives attacking Ahmadinejad. You have show trials of the reformist parties. So in this environment, how are you going to get a decision from a supreme leader who doesn't look so supreme anymore or from Ahmadinejad with his tainted victory? How are you going to get an agreement among those forces to engage with the U.S.?
David.
The paradox of the situation is that the United States and Iran share a number of interests. Most specifically, they share an interest in the success of this Iraqi government under Prime Minister Maliki in stabilizing the country. They both support that as a goal. You'd think they'd find some way to cooperate on that, but quite the opposite seems to be happening. U.S.-Iran tension inside Iraq, near as I can tell, is increasing.
We should talk perhaps briefly about Pakistan. More violence this week, Janine. In the tribal areas, a suicide bomber blew up people at the border along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border as they were meeting to break the Ramadan fast. Different estimates of the number of people who were killed, 19 said one report, 22 said another report. What's happening in Pakistan?
Well, they're basically trying to get a grip on the Swat Valley and the areas there along the border. Again, the U.S. equally concerned about stability in Pakistan as they are in Afghanistan. It's all sort of the same thing. They scored somewhat of a victory with the killing of Baitullah Massoud, a leading militant there who was, among other things, implicated in the death of Benazir Bhutto in late 2007. But sure enough, as soon as his death was confirmed, his successor was named. So it just illustrates the difficulties going forward in trying to get a handle on the violence in that area, the area along the border where the al-Qaeda leadership is pretty much holed up.
David.
Despite this attack at Torquem Gate on the border, spectacular place that I and perhaps others here have visited, there is some reason to think that things are going a little bit better for the Pakistanis in their effort to suppress the Pakistani Taliban. We've talked about so much bad news this morning, but I would say that this is a small piece of good news. The fact that they were able to target Baitullah Massoud with an unmanned Predator drone and kill him, first was the product of good intelligence cooperation between the U.S. and Pakistan. That cooperation has been intense. I mean, they've had a real war room going every day. And there's a number of opportunities that open up in the confusion that has resulted in the aftermath of his death among the Taliban that are being exploited pretty aggressively. So this is one area where I think people are a little bit more upbeat than they were a couple months ago.
Barbara.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, just a couple months ago, we were talking about the collapse of Pakistan, of the Taliban marching into Islamabad and taking over the nuclear weapons. So there has been a change. You know, we have to see how durable it is, but certainly it seems as though relations between the U.S. and Pakistan are much improved in the last couple of months.
We're going to go to Dayton, Ohio, and talk to Mohammed. Mohammed, thanks for holding on.
Thank you very much. My question is actually pertaining to Japan, and I was reading the Financial Times article yesterday depicting the woes of the current leading party in Japan. And my question is, what is the idea? I understand you already guys talked about some of the differences between the DPJ and the LDP, but I read a series of fiction novels by Barry Eisler, based in Japan, and I understand that, you know, the LDP really has been pushing for, has been really doling out infrastructure spending for the past, you know, how many decades. And I want to know if the DPJ is also, you know, on the same platform of infrastructure spending to kind of curtail unemployment and so on and so forth, on top of their ideological differences between LDP in relation to the U.S. relations. I mean, it's, I think it's a big deal. So.
Okay, Mohammed, thanks for your call. David?
Mohammed has it right. The LDP was famous for keeping itself in power by the way U.S. political parties used to, by building post offices and roads and all these public works projects and everybody, you know, all this employment for friends of the party. The hope is that this new Democratic Party will be more market-oriented. They're talking about stimulus spending that won't build more darn roads. Japan has too much concrete already, but will dynamize other new industries. And as we've said earlier, will that work? Who knows?
We have news from North Korea this week. North Korea has threatened to stop disabling its nuclear plant if the U.S. continues to keep the country on its list of states that sponsor terrorism. Boy, Barbara, it seems like we never stop talking about North Korea and efforts to address its nuclear program.
I'm a little confused about this. Wait, they're off the list of state sponsors of terrorism. So maybe they're threatening if we put them back on the list. I mean, the Bush administration in one of its final acts was to take North Korea off the terrorism list because they thought they had a deal on the nukes, and of course that has fallen apart. The thing about North Korea, people talk about judo diplomacy, how they manage. This is a tiny little country full of starving people that somehow manages to attract all this attention and to sort of completely unbalance its enemies, its opponents, and so on. And we've seen it once again. They took it all the way to the brink. They had nuclear tests. They threatened all sorts of terrible things. And then, of course, Bill Clinton went. They released these two women. They've had meetings now with the South Koreans. They've agreed now to have meetings between divided families divided by the Korean War. And so now we've got a charm offensive. What does this mean? Nobody really knows, except they're trying to keep us all off balance.
Let's talk to Anthony. He's calling us from Dallas, Texas. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. I really wanted to see if I could find out where I or anyone really could find evidence to substantiate the position that the Iranian election was unduly influenced by the current government, that it was fixed. In other words, I really haven't – all I've seen are statements of opinion on that or unsubstantiated arguments. I'm really wondering if there is – maybe some single or some easily findable evidence online or elsewhere that I could look at that would substantiate that. Also, if there's evidence to substantiate the position or view that the current trials in Iran are a kangaroo court and the admissions of guilt given by some of the defendants are coerced or false. Also, a third question unrelated to that would be, could someone just speak to how long was the Soviet Union engaged in Afghanistan compared to our current engagement and what the differences might be there? But I really would like to know about the Iranian sources
all right.
of evidence.
Anthony, thanks so much for your call. Barbara, I think Barbara has some places for you to go.
Oh, yeah. You can check out Chatham House, which did a very good analysis of the elections. But let me just point out one thing. Iran has a paper ballot system. And it takes a long time to tally up votes. Normally, they don't announce even preliminary results until the next day. 1 hour after the polls closed, the Iranian government, the Interior Ministry, announced that Ahmadinejad had won by a landslide. It was completely absurd. There are credible reports from people, I've interviewed others, that ballot boxes were taken away from polling stations. They were not opened and votes counted in front of observers. There were reports that there were 10 million additional ballots that were printed beyond the 40-some-odd million that should have been printed for eligible voters. So wherever you look, there are indications of fraud. Also, in 1997, something like 70% of the population voted for a reformer, Mohammad Khatami. Same thing happened again 4 years later. He got, I think, even a larger percentage of the vote. How could all of these people suddenly turn around and support Ahmadinejad? It just doesn't compute.
Do you think, David, there's any question about that there was a fair amount of fraud in this election?
The evidence that there was fraud seems substantial. Whether Mousavi, the opposition candidate, won or not is a different question. There are some people in the U.S. government who think there was sizable fraud, but Mousavi may have won anyway. The question is, if you're going to be fraudulent, why push it all the way to 62% when all you needed was 51%?
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You know, Anthony had a second question, which was comparing the length of the Soviet involvement in Afghanistan with that of the United States so far. Can any of our panel address that question?
Can I just say one other
yes.
word about his question about the show trials? I know a lot of the people who are on trial. I've interviewed them for my book, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies. I mean, I know that these people are not speaking the truth. They look terrible. They're haggard. They clearly have been under duress, and they're saying things that are just the complete reverse of what they have said in the past when they were not under duress.
And what about Anthony's question about the duration of the wars?
As I remember it, the Soviets went in 1979, and they left, if I'm remembering, roughly 10 years later. And they were, it's terrible to say this, they had the same list of enemies and the same list of allies that we do for the most part. And it didn't work out well.
The Dalai Lama is going to Taiwan. Now, we've had one emailer saying I'm mispronouncing the Dalai Lama's name, that it should be, tell us, David.
Well, I'm no expert, but I say Dalai Lama.
All right. Well, however you pronounce it, he's going to Taiwan. Who invited him, Janine?
Well, the government did. The president there, he's under a little bit of pressure right now because of the way he handled the typhoon there, and they're seeing it as a political gesture. The sense I'm getting is that while China is voicing its protests of the Dalai Lama's visit there, as it voices its protests of anywhere he travels, it's not necessarily going to impact the nascent rapprochement that you've got between China and Taiwan. Just today, China announced that it was licensing 16 airlines to fly direct flights to Taiwan. They've established a regular trade there. China, rather, is Taiwan's biggest trading partner. So I don't think it's going to have a really negative impact.
Barbara.
Yeah, I think the original invitation came from an opposition party, the opposition Democratic Progressive Party in Taiwan, and then the Taiwanese leader had to sort of endorse it because there are a lot of Buddhists in Taiwan, so he didn't want to look like he was offending them. But I agree with Janine. I don't think the Chinese are going to jeopardize their ties with Taiwan over it.
Barbara Slavin of The Washington Times, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, and Janine Zakaria of Bloomberg News. I want to thank all three of you for joining us this hour for the international portion of our Friday News Roundup.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.